The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. We're the official media partner at the Better Way Conference in Bath, United Kingdom. We're today's news talk radio. TNT. Speaking on the issues that impact. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. We're in hour number two of this live broadcast right now. We are in Bath, England, the amazing city of Bath, England. And this is the Better Way Conference. It's sponsored by the World Council for Health. And some amazing speakers here. We've been very fortunate to have some of us join us here on stage, on the TNT pop-up studio stage. We've got going on the sidelines here. And one of the guests that we're going to welcome to that stage right now is Dr. Simon Godak, somebody that many people will know on the social media platforms like Twitter. I've definitely been following Simon, not just for COVID-related matters, but for other things too. And welcome to the program, Simon.
Thank you.
And so you've come a little bit of a long way, haven't you, to be here?
Oh, I've been traveling 40 hours from Brazil. There were some issues with the flights. But yeah, I finally made it. It was like sleeping two nights in the airplane. I'm not the best sleeper in the airplane, so I took some like 5 milligrams of melatonin each night. And this made me like sleep like a baby. So.
Oh, really? Does that work?
It works very well,
I'm going to have to get into that.
You should.
That's a good little tip. So coming from Brazil all the way to England, couldn't get two different cultures, two different civilizations, very different countries, England and Brazil. And and you're a refugee from Europe to Brazil.
Yeah, yeah.
And what brought you to Brazil?
Well, COVID. So I got more or less pressed in Europe by, the politicians and the measures they put in place.
You were very outspoken, weren't you? You were one of the people kind of publicly challenging a lot of stuff.
Yes, I think I was one of the earliest voices. I started in 2020 already to criticize what's happening. And the reason why I got silenced was because I spoke out against the Dutch state virologist, Marion Koopmans. Who eventually was corrupt, as I stated. She got like money from the Chinese Communist Party. And then she was removed from some WHO council afterwards. And she was a co-author of this Drosten PCR protocol paper.
Uh-huh.
And I was criticizing this. I was like, it cannot pass peer review within 24 hours. I did an analysis on this. And so my Dutch university got rid of me because of the statement, which was totally true. And they were telling me, yeah, they will get another employee who's less critical. So this was their statement, and yeah, I had issues with my bank account, my PayPal got frozen. So I was just going to Brazil, because back then Bolsonaro was president in Brazil, and I felt it's a safer place. As my partner is Brazilian, it was much easier to just go over there instead of trying to find a place on my own to start a new beginning.
I noticed, and some of my friends went to Brazil as well, and they said that they were in north of Bahia, far north of Bahia, and they said they just basically they skipped the pandemic. Some of these areas in Brazil, they just kind of didn't really comply with or know about. Some he said didn't even know about it. He said, "Oh, that thing that happened in Europe." When she would ask them, "Do you know about COVID?" He said, "Well, I think so. This is happening in America."
It's totally that's true. So if you went to bigger Brazilian cities like Sao Paulo, everybody would wear a mask even outside. So there were like some cycling teams outside, like practicing, and the whole cycling team would be wearing a mask in Sao Paulo. It's totally insane. And when you go to the countryside, you saw like you had a totally different picture of COVID. So close to my place in the jungle, I haven't seen any mask. Like nobody was wearing a mask, and people were like, "Okay, well, we don't take this seriously." Bolsonaro says it's not that dangerous, so they were believing him. So I mean, like they also listened to politicians, to be honest, and they were not reading papers themselves.
And so, right now, your work, right now, what if you're out of academia? Are you still kind of working in that field? Are you doing any professional work? Are you right now a totally independent individual you're basically doing what you want in, you know, outside of that system?
Yeah, well, after I got canceled in the Netherlands, I worked for a Norwegian research institute. Well, after I got my Twitter account back, I got fired right away. So just for, what did they say? Exceeding the freedom of expression. That's what they said.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, how can you exceed? It's super bizarre.
Did you get that in writing?
Yes, I got it in writing twice.
That's an amazing thing to have in writing.
My lawyer is celebrating this. She's having a good time. So now I'm suing them because they deserve it. Syntef in Norway. I'm using the names. People get to know whom not to work. And now I'm totally independent. So it was quite a step to get independent, like, that quickly. So I'm writing articles for Brownstone Institute.
Very good.
And I'm having my vitamin D startup with an innovative product, sunfluencer.com. I mean, I don't even get close to what, of course, I'm from a Norwegian company. I mean, in Norway, they have, like, one of the highest salaries in the world. So I don't even get there. But at least I'm not selling my soul. And I'm still being able to speak my mind. And there's no more need for self-censorship that I did within like the first 2 or 3 weeks when I got back on Twitter. And so I was trying to be very careful what I said. But obviously they got like emails from maybe Bill Gates Foundation, other big players. So that at least that's what I was told, that they got,
they got
emails from big foundations.
They leaned on them? The Bill Gates' foundation leaned on them?
I was giving the hint orally. Because I was calling them out, so it makes sense. And there were other players as well, other big accounts on Twitter as well that obviously contacted my former employer. So they got rid of me very quickly. But yeah, that's part of the game. I was already expecting that, and I know since October that we would get our Twitter accounts back. So and as soon as I as soon as I got fired, I could start. I was able to start my new project right away.
And then, so you're on a couple panels this weekend. I know that Saturday and Sunday. What discussions are you going to be taking part in?
I think I'm only on the panel on Sunday, but maybe I don't know. And I will talk about how to grow the perfect mango. So, and of course some other stuff. So because it's not like a horticultural place here. I will tell my story, how I got canceled, and for which tweets I got canceled, for which stories I got canceled. I mean, I got canceled on Twitter 3 times as well for ridiculous tweets. For example, once I was asked the Bill Gates Foundation why they invested money in BioNTech in September 2019. Super simple question. I got canceled for that, for misinformation, for asking a question to the Bill Gates Foundation. So that's going to be quite interesting for what we got, like scientists like me got canceled back then. So I'll just tell my story. I think that interests people the most. I mean, I could talk about the Bayes theorem. I could talk about the metabolism. I could talk about data analysis. But I think most people would fall asleep. So I think telling my personal story is maybe the most exciting thing I can do.
What did you do your doctorate in, your advanced degrees? What area were you focused in?
So my master's was water technology and management. So I was looking into water technology systems. I think I did some assessment on the flood system in Vietnam, quite random. And my PhD was on system dynamics and biotechnology. So I was looking into building bioreactors. And I was looking into multi-loop aquaponics systems. That's what we got the money for. The same with my postdocs. So it was always aquaponics, but I've also publications in the metabolism. I have publications in vitamin D and mathematical models. So there's a broad range, but it all comes back to system dynamics and modeling itself, which I don't see as science anymore.
Okay. Well, look, we're going to go to break in a couple of minutes, but before we go to break, I wanted to also introduce a couple of more guests that are going to be coming on to the show a little bit later. I think James Corbett is also due to join us shortly, and maybe Clive DeCarl as well. Right now we're with Dr. Simon Godek, and he's traveled a long way to be here. We're at the Better Way Conference in Bath, England. And this is an amazing event. What's your impressions with this type of a gathering, Simon? Are there a lot of people here that you knew virtually that you're finally being able to connect with in real life?
Yeah, let's just be honest. I'm always honest, being autistic. So I was quite shocked that they let Rainer Fömich speak. But he was speaking via Zoom. I think he's still in Mexico with the money he has stolen from the people, the donations. I think it was several million. So this was something I was quite shocked about. That's not the way to go, you know.
Oh, besides that, what about anyone else that consider a colleague?
Yes, of course. I've met Robin Minotti finally, which is great, and I've met some other people who I know just virtually until now. I met you. Here we go. It's next to the other. I mean, that's really amazing. But I mean, I'm mostly associated with the American players, and there are not many of them over here. But it's still very interesting to finally see faces instead of just email addresses, you know,
yeah.
Which was the case before, or Twitter profiles. So it's a great chance to exchange knowledge, to exchange ideas, and to know each other.
No, for me it's a great networking opportunity, you know. And it's very rare. We spend a lot of time in front of screens these days. I know I do because of my work. It's all digital now. But when they do get a chance to come to a live event to attend or speak, I absolutely clear my schedule for it now, and I work around other ways to get other work done or work on the road. Because I think it's just so important right now. We all got a taste of what it was like to be really physically isolated during that whole lockdown farrago in 2020. And I think that really made a lot of people realize that, we have to push really hard to make sure that we meet, that we have meetings, conferences, that we get together and share ideas, to present, to have debate. I like the fact that they have, pretty big panels assembled for this. So there's going to be some back and forth discussion. It's just not all linear presentations. So that's one of the things I like about this event. There's some events you go to and there's just a lineup of speakers. They present more like a symposium.
Yeah.
But this is a lot more interactive. I like it.
Yeah, it's different. I've only been to scientific, like totally scientific conferences. And there you got like the PhD students, the postdocs, and they would just like present some data. Everybody would be sleeping. Nobody's actually interested in what they're presenting. And here it's quite interesting and everybody seems to be excited, which makes this event totally, totally different.
Well, we're here at the Better Way Conference in Bath, England, and we're amongst the attendees right now. They're kind of milling about our pop-up studio here in Bath, England. And it's an amazing event. Amazing people, and I've learned a lot so far since I've been here. There's more to come on Saturday and Sunday, and I want to thank Dr. Simon Godek for coming so far to be here and also joining us here in our pop-up studio with TNT Radio. Much appreciated, Simon.
Thank you.
And it was great to meet you in real life, finally, and hopefully we'll catch up during the conference as well. We're going to go to break now with the network, so stick around. This is TNT, today's News Talk. I'm Patrick Henningsen, your host. We'll be right back.
You should hear what Chris Smith is talking about.
As Florida governor, the latest presidential candidate to put his hand up, Ron DeSantis, just killed any chance he had of becoming the president of the United States by wrongly defining his mission statement this week. Did you hear what DeSantis said on Tuesday? And his damning of wokeness. Now, that's not his mistake. In fact, that's his key policy and one which will resonate with many Republicans. That's a good policy. That's a great mission statement. It's what he said alongside that promise that I think may be a terrible own goal.
Everyone knows if I'm the nominee, I will beat Biden and I will serve two terms and I will be able to destroy leftism in this country and leave woke ideology on the dustbin of history.
He's out to destroy leftism. Leftism. What is leftism? Someone who considers themselves left-leaning politically. Does he really think that he doesn't need normally left-leaning or often left-leaning voters to win the presidency? Does he really think he can glide into office on the back of Republican votes only? He hasn't done his homework. History tells us that it's the swinging middle. Americans who may consider themselves left most of the time or just some of the time who decide elections.
Chris Smith on TNT Radio.
Affordable housing. We can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
TNT Radio is taking a stand for freedom. Coming to you from the Better Way Conference in Bath, United Kingdom. This is today's news talk, TNT Radio. Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
Here we go, hour number two. Hour number two, we're coming in live from the Better Way Conference in Bath, England. Amazing segment before the break, Dr. Simon Godek and also Derek Brose before that. And very pleased to be joined in our pop-up studio by another special guest, one of the many great speakers who's here at this event this weekend, who's also traveled a long way. Everyone we've had on, James, has traveled a long way. James Corbett from the Corbett Report, a man who needs no introduction. But how are you doing?
After the flight from Japan, a little bit jet lagged, but I'm doing okay.
So, yeah, so you recovered from your jet lag yesterday.
Yeah, that's right.
So now you're feeling like a human.
I'm back at it, yeah.
So, James, there's a lot going on here, and a lot of people will say that this is kind of a health-oriented conference, but there's a lot more going on here than that, and I think you're involved in some of the discussions.
Right, yeah, because the biosecurity agenda is kind of the linchpin of global geopolitics at the moment, and it's just one, in a sense, it's actually a spoke on one of the spokes on a wheel, and there's many different aspects to it, but biosecurity is absolutely an important part of the agenda that's unfolding right now.
And so when we talk about biosecurity or the biosecurity framework or industrial complex, this is not a foreign concept to you because your work, you've already seen other types of security complexes put into place. Has that helped you to really recognize what you've been working on with 9/11?
Exactly. I think so. And so I did a documentary called COVID-911, From Homeland Security to Biosecurity, a couple of years ago, that lays out the historical continuities between the Homeland Security agenda, the biosecurity agenda. It was always about trying to take some sort of amorphous war on an abstract noun and demonize segments of the population and put them into boxes like terrorist. But now it's bioterrorist. And it's even better in a case where you have some sort of disease that can be spread. You might not even know you have it, but you're a bioterrorist essentially spreading this disease. It allows the oligarchy to take the weaponry of control of the Homeland Security state and weaponize it against anyone they want at any time, as long as your QR code scans and it gives the red beep or whatever they trick it to do. You're essentially, if you're pigeonholed, you're gone.
So when the whole pandemic thing dropped and you were in Japan, I assume, and so what was it like? What was that like there? How did the kind of did the dystopia unfold there? Or was it different?
It was absolutely dystopia, but it was absolutely different than I think a lot of people's experience, because in Japan there was never a lockdown, there was never a mandate of any sort, mask or vaccine or anything, at least not legally. But in terms of what actually took place was the horizontal tyranny. It wasn't the top-down tyranny. It was the horizontal tyranny that manifests through a country where it is essentially a neo-feudal population that has lived under some form of feudalism for so many centuries that the old feudal lords were essentially taken over by the zaibatsu, the corporations that essentially dictate people's lives. So if the owner of your company says, okay, you're all getting jabbed today, then everyone gets jabbed.
Did you, I know, like when the pandemic was happening and you were, so you're looking back at your home country, which is Canada.
Yeah.
that was a sort of a special case, wasn't it?
Yeah. And yet also, not only some of the darkest things from the past few years of the biosecurity agenda, but some of the brightest parts, the trucker freedom movement
definitely.
And what happened there. And I think perhaps that's not a coincidence. Where the oppression is the strongest, the opposite direction will fight back.
That was hugely inspirational. Mm. They inspired the world, the Canadian truckers.
Yeah.
And you could also, from that, a lot of lessons to be learned. Australia, too. Mm. They had it really heavy. Yeah. And the freedom movement in Australia was really inspirational. I think Canada and Australia inspired a lot of people around the world to kind of, you know, step up and, you know.
Canada, Australia, New Zealand, England. I wonder if there's a connection there.
Yeah. The Five Eyes complex.
Yeah.
So we're back here at the Better Way conference in Bath, England. We're amongst the conference attendees here in our pop-up studio. We're joined by James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And James, I know that you primarily were a filmmaker. That's how you communicated to the world for years. Has your work changed what you do in recent years or how you approach your work?
Yeah, it is constantly evolving. In fact, I originally started, it was only going to be a podcast, but immediately it became articles and interviews and videos and what have you. So I am evolving what I do, but fundamentally it's mostly the same. I might change the production techniques or what I'm doing, but essentially I'm just trying to put information out there in a way that's going to be accessible to people. And the funny thing about it is that 20 years ago when I was studying English literature and what are you going to do with that degree? And I don't know, frame it. In a strange way, it's kind of come full circle for me because essentially what I'm doing is I'm writing essays and using evidence to back up what I'm saying and formulate an argument and what have you. But now I'm doing it in a format that didn't exist when I was a student that I could never have possibly foreseen. But it's essentially the same thing.
In terms of the issues, I know that during the so-called, I hate using the term pandemic because it wasn't a pandemic, but during the so-called pandemic, you did a couple of films I think were high impact. One of them was Your Great Reset film. And so in that sort of COVID genre, you had a couple of big ones that went viral and that kind of were able to kind of get to the mainstream audience.
Yeah, a little bit. The Who is Bill Gates documentary.
That's the one.
That was the last video I've ever done or would ever do that would hit a million plus views because, of course, it wasn't long after that I got scrubbed from YouTube. So I'm not reaching out to the masses in that way anymore.
How did that feel? Because you've been on YouTube since before YouTube existed.
Yeah.
You were on there for
a long time. And the thing is, I've always had the sense that it was enemy territory. I never thought that Google was going to be handing us this platform on a platter to communicate whatever we want. So I was telling my audience over and over and over for years and years and years, you are going to lose my voice if you're only watching me on YouTube. You have to go to CorbettReport.com or you will not find me. And I said it a million times. And after I eventually, of course, did get scrubbed from YouTube, I did hear from some people who said, well, you know, I thought you were being hyperbolic, but it turns out you were actually right.
That's a good lesson. Like you developed your own website, your own media. You own it. Technically, it can't be. I suppose if they really wanted to do the URL, but it is the safe option if you have a good body of work to be able to have a place
And there's no excuse not to in this day and age. It is not that difficult to set up just a basic website and just host your audio, video files, whatever you can do. And if you don't have it stored, you don't have it.
And in terms of where things are going now, what are you looking a lot at in terms of geopolitics? How's Ukraine or some of these other issues? What are you sort of looking at right now?
Geopolitically, I am. If people say, what do you predict for the future? I generally say short term, vaccine, digital ID, something along those lines. Medium term, CBDC, long term, hot war. And I think we are being engineered towards some sort of World War III type scenario. And you can already see the battle lines forming. It's not going to be, it's one of those things, what was the old Hemingway quote? How did you go broke? Very slowly, then all of a sudden, or whatever the quote is. I think we can see where things are drifting and whatever incident it is, whatever Archduke gets assassinated that suddenly sets everything off, it will, in hindsight, everyone will go, oh, of course, we were heading towards war. But I see the writing on the wall right now, and a lot of eerie parallels, pre-World War I parallels and pre-World War II parallels.
Hemingway did, when he went, actually went broke, he had a house in Key West, and he had one of the first in-ground swimming pools he had built, and that's what led to his final bankruptcy, and the pavement was still wet, and he had one penny left, and he was cursed it and threw it down and stuck in the wet cement on this new pool that he didn't have any money left, and it's still there. They put a piece of glass over the penny.
Nice.
And the sort of 100 cats that live in his house there. But the World War III conversation might have sounded hyperbolic. I mean, I didn't believe that we had. I thought the end of the Cold War is like we've at least emancipated from thermonuclear as a threat.
Right.
But do you feel that that's not the case now?
I often say I have no idea how World War III will be fought, but I know it will be completely different than World War I or World War II. In the same way, World War I was absolutely completely different than anything that had come before it and completely reconceptualized what war even is. So geopolitically, who knows what kind of weird satellite robot army, whatever nonsense they're going to try to pull. But actually, I often try to remind people, I think we are already in World War III. But it's a war of every government against its own people. It is an internal war in that sense for control of the human population, essentially. And that is manifested as a fifth generation war that takes place in the financial domain, economic, monetary, biological agents, genetic engineering, you name it.
Information space?
Information, of course.
Which is where you're on the front lines of that. Yeah. And so you've felt this, you know, you've had a personal, you know, interactions with the machine in being censored and being canceled.
Yeah.
I think going forward, I'm really concerned about the CBDC issue because that's such a fundamental difference in the concept of money and anonymous purchases and things like this. What about in Asia? Is the CBDC agenda being basically put on track?
I had an article last year that was trying to keep track of it, as many countries as I could find, where they were at in terms of their development. And I don't know, I got to 83 of them or whatever it was before I just kind of gave up. Basically, every country on the planet is moving towards it right now. You'd be hard-pressed to find an exception. I believe Japan has said that they're not going to implement a retail CBDC, but they're testing it anyway, essentially. Seemingly every government in the world is on board with this agenda in some way. It seems inevitable in some way. The real question is how they will sell it to the public, because essentially it can be done. They want to do it. They're going to implement it, but can they get the public to go along with it? And I think if I was an oligarch trying to steer the people into some sort of brand new monetary paradigm that could be so potentially completely tyrannical, the way I would do it is very gradually and sort of incentivize people and, oh, don't worry, we're protecting your privacy and you'll get a little discount if you use your CBDC and you've still got your cash, you've still got your other payments, but we'll put this alongside and then eventually sort of get enough people to trust it, essentially, and before you pull the hammer. But the oligarchs that shouldn't be, not being particularly wise, I think they might try some monetary false flag, essentially, bank run. Suddenly, you know, the banks close, and on Monday, you've got CBDCs.
That would be the I don't want to give them any. Or they already have their ideas, James. But a failure of banks, and then they say, "Don't worry, we put a few grand in your download the app," and then all of a sudden,
because as Americans know, it was 1907, the Panic of 1907, which J.P. Morgan may or may not have instituted himself, but at any rate, he came along as the savior to bail out the banks that he wanted to bail out, not bailing out his competition. And what came of that? Of course, the secret meeting on Jekyll Island and ultimately the Federal Reserve. So, if they want to pull a monetary false flag, I think they know how to do it.
And also a war could trigger an economic calamity as well.
Unfortunately, these things often go together. Federal Reserve 1913, World War I 1914, America's in World War I by 1917. World War II, you have the economic turbulence of the 30s leading directly into the World War II. The parallels are there.
I've also seen recently, I know because you're here, I want to get your opinion on this. NATO wants to open a liaison office in Japan.
Yes.
So what on earth is going on here. NATO wants to expand to the Pacific.
Yeah,
what do you think?
We have to give them a map and show them where. No, this is unfortunately part of a long process whereby there are a number of partner countries and things. They have a partner program. I believe Korea might be part of that. There's places basically every corner of the globe, but it's not even just the globe. I think it was a few years ago at the NATO summit that they announced that the next, of course, war fighting domain that NATO is going to conquer is space. So literally no part of the globe and no part of space is going to be untouched by the NATO powers that shouldn't be.
Yeah, satellite, there's more satellites in the air right now. Starlink has added another. I think they went 30,000 altogether. Mm. That's like their sort of goal in terms of like setting up these sort of battle space, if you will. And it's like everything can be seen on the ground now. I see this with Ukraine. You've got the Russians with their satellites. You've got the Americans with their satellites. And everybody's trying to basically get as much information as they can back to inform the people on the ground. You've got drones now.
Yep.
You've got unmanned everything.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different warfare is changing.
Yeah, and that's what I was referring to earlier. Again, World War III, when and if it breaks out, I don't think we know half of the technologies that are being developed in the skunk works at the Pentagon. Who knows what it's going to look like, but I just don't think it's going to be anything like World War II.
Yeah, there's a lot of people selling military hardware now. I see them on the news all the time, representatives from all these companies. I guess business is good right now, if you're in that sort of game.
Sometimes I get asked, you know, well, okay, knowing what you know, what should we be investing in? And I said, well, if you just want to make money, just invest in the military-industrial complex. You're probably not going to go broke. I don't think that's the right thing to do, but it's probably a good way to make money within this controlled paradigm that we're in.
And then also, I noticed as well, and this has happened as well in recent years, is China has been somehow positioned as the default existential enemy for America. It's almost like there's a script that's been distributed, and everybody's saying, well, China's our greatest adversary. And I'm looking at China, they haven't really done much different than they did 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
They haven't changed, but the rhetoric in the West has changed.
Yeah.
What are your feelings on that?
So I talked about this in Denmark a few years ago. I gave a speech on Echoes of World War One, where I talked about the Thucydides trap, the idea that when you have a rising power that's coming up against an established power, more often than not, you're going to get war. And the parallels between the rising German power in the turn of the 20th century threatening the British Empire versus the 21st century and the rise of the geoeconomic rise of China versus the U.S. empire are obviously the parallels are there. And actually, in this case, at any rate, I think we have to also look at the ties of various American financial oligarchs to the Chinese, the rise of China. China didn't just become this rising economic power all of a sudden by itself. No, there were deep-seated ties that were planted as far back as ultimately Rockefeller in the 80s, in fact, in the 70s. People say it was Nixon who went to China. Well, it was Kissinger who went on a secret mission 1 year before Nixon to basically break the diplomatic deadlock between China and America. And of course, Kissinger was literally working for Rockefeller at the time. We can see these ties. So I think there's a more complicated story going on. But yes, definitely in the past 5 to 10 years, they have flipped that switch. The script has been given, and we are definitely seeing the rise of China as the new enemy. And maybe it will just turn into Cold War 2.0. And so there's no actual hot live war, and that would be not a good thing, but not the worst thing that could happen. But unfortunately, I do see a lot of signs that we could be heading to actual war.
I'm worried because I've been in debates with American pundits, and they're saying to me, we must prevail in Ukraine because if the Ukrainians don't win, then it's going to encourage China to take Taiwan. The domino theory.
Yep.
And I'm like, this sounds like the Cold War again. Yep. It's just it's not communism. It's now authoritarianism and democracies.
Exactly. No, we are being haunted by the same spirits. Unfortunately, these foreign policy ideas, once they get embedded, are particularly persistent, even if they lead to absolute nonsense, as we saw in the development of the Cold War, where, oh, by the way, of course, the Soviet Empire was held up and propped up for a long time by American industrial and financial might, the Lend-Lease program onward. I think there's a similar parallel going on right now. And you look at the works of Anthony Sutton, who documented that. It was the American financial elite that were basically propping up the Soviet Empire as the boogeyman, the best enemies money can buy. Why? In order to ultimately, well, the long-term strategy is to merge the systems, but at least in the short term, it's certainly good business for everyone. And we are seeing, I think, a very similar thing playing out right now, where, of course, the rise of China economically took place because of a concerted effort over the past few decades to put in the monetary, financial links, banking links that led to corporate, offshoring that obviously propped up Chinese manufacturing industry and gutted out American manufacturing industry, and R&D, incredible emplacement of R&D of almost every Fortune 500 company in China, which also, oh, by the way, always has as part of the stipulations of putting R&D facilities in China is that, oh, we get some share of the whatever intellectual property you're developing here, and we'll take a little bit of that. And now we have all of these Chinese massive military advancements that, well, that's an exact copy of this American military advancement. Whether you're looking at the jump jets or the drones or what have you, it always seems to be oddly like they're stealing American technology. How is this happening? Anyway, now there's this big Chinese boogeyman that we have to worry about.
Anthony Sutton and his research informed the work of Patrick Wood.
Yes, they were co-authors about Trilateral Commission. And he's talked about technocracy, which absolutely is one of the most important aspects of what's happening, because what we are facing fundamentally, I don't think is a geopolitical game itself. It's about an ideology. And I think one of the bases of the ideology is not communism, it's not fascism, it's not capitalism, it is technocracy. It's the idea that we are going to put enormous amounts of power in the hands of a very few technical elite who will essentially be able to steward society at the flip of a switch, literally, as we start to get into the CBDCs and what have you.
And Patrick Wood also puts the Trilateral Commission as an important component of that. The Trilateral being Japan, yeah, Europe, and America. How relevant is that, or are there plans coming into fruition now? What's your opinion on the Trilateral Commission and its relevance?
Yeah, I believe didn't the Trilaterals declare this year, or was it last year, the year one of the New World Order?
Year one.
I believe so. Okay. Yeah, something along those lines. Anyway, yeah, they still exist and they're still a force. Although I would say that the relevance that Japan had in the 70s and 80s probably on the geopolitical scale is less right now. Japan is just handy as the American proxy in the Asia Pacific, the Indo Pacific, as we're supposed to say now, right? Trilateral still exists, Bilderberg still exists, the World Economic Forum exists. There are all of these organizations. I'm not sure if any one of them is the deciding factor in this. I think this is ultimately more about an ideology than it is about a particular group.
If someone, because I get asked this all the time, I don't ask your opinion. They say, what's the difference? People say, what's the difference between the Bilderberg Group and the World Economic Forum in terms of like what they do or the impact they have? How, if someone asked you that, how would you answer that question?
Well, it's fascinating to me because Bilderberg is one of the things that when I started doing this, I started researching Bilderberg deeply because it was genuinely surprising to me that, oh, every year there's 125 or so of the top business corporate chieftains, financial oligarchs, royalty, sitting prime ministers, all these heads of state meeting together in complete secrecy. And when I started researching this back in the mid-2000s, it was still a conspiracy theory that Bilderberg even existed, which is pretty remarkable because it started in the 1950s. So that to me was just a self-evident, well, this is conspiracy. This is the definition of it, not conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy reality. And it was fascinating to watch that information about Bilderberg start to sort of pervade the public consciousness a bit, to the point where ultimately they created their website, they openly announced the meetings, they have their guest list, and probably a few people who aren't on the guest list, but whatever, close enough. And it was, perhaps that was a wonderful strategy for disarming the people who were starting to actually get interested in that particular meeting, because now no one talks about Bilderberg, but everyone is interested in the World Economic Forum. And I get that to a certain extent, because I think Klaus Schwab is a great carnival barker, and he is barking people in the door of the World Economic Forum. Hey, we've got this Great Reset initiative. We're talking about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He's great at branding these ideas that are already swirling around, but World Economic Forum is thousands of people coming to Davos, and it's certainly not elite like the Bilderberg meetings are.
Yeah, and they don't have a secret Chatham House agenda.
Yeah.
But Klaus Schwab, I think he's a protege of Kissinger.
Indeed he is, yeah. So the apples don't fall far from the tree. But again, I think that reflects back on the idea. I don't think it's any one particular group. I mean, you look at someone like Kissinger, he worked for Rockefeller, he's Bilderberg, he's World Economic Forum, many, many, many other fingers in many other pies. He's just a super gopher, as David Rothkopf, who was essentially mini Kissinger, took over Kissinger and Associates. He wrote a book back in 2007, 2008, Superclass, about the 6,000 or so people who transcend national boundaries. They can enact an international agenda across national boundaries. They're not necessarily in government. They may be in business or what have you. But these are the people who are really shaping the world. And, of course, Rothkopf's idea was, well, this is a good thing. You know, these are the great people. And I think Kissinger is just a reflection of that. But these are people who ultimately are in service of an ideology of centralized control. And they believe that they are going to be able to puppeteer society in a way that will be beneficial to everyone. I'm sure a lot of people who are involved in this genuinely believe that they're the good guys and they're doing what's right for humanity. But that doesn't make it obviously right what they're doing. And by abrogating our basic bodily autonomy, our independent sovereignty, our monetary sovereignty, I think they are obviously working towards the creation of what will be a one world government of some sort or other. And one world government doesn't necessarily mean a central government in Brussels or that controls the world. It may take the form of competing power blocks, essentially, East Asia, Eurasia, Oceania, to use the 1984 reference, but something along those lines, where it may be a global structure of control, where there are people who share an ideology behind the scenes who are working together, but overtly, there may be different power blocks that are vying against each other.
And the digital component seems to be like the method to, you know, govern by technocracy. So, and it was interesting, a friend of mine is serving in the active duty in the military here, showed me the app. And they have the life all in one app that has their military, has their health, it has their vaccination, it has their money, it has their bank, it has their just whatever. Even news feed, it's even got an internal news feed. Travel, their scoring, they have an internal kind of not a social credit score, but there's certain status you have. You know, you're up to date on your training, you've done this course, it's all in one app.
You know, that reminds me of the remarkable coincidence that in, I believe it was 2003, when Facebook officially launched, was the exact day that DARPA canceled their LifeLog program, which was this app that they were developing at that time that was going to be the everything, could collect all your information. But that got scrapped because of the public got wind of it and weren't happy about the privacy implications, literally the same day Facebook got started.
Yeah, Facebook and the other ones, DARPA features in all of these, a lot of these organizations. InQtel.
Yes, InQtel is the investment capital arm of the CIA that's funded, obviously, a lot of ventures. And it was someone who was with InQtel, I believe he was the head of InQtel at the time, who accompanied Elon Musk to Russia back in 2002, 2003, when Musk was trying to source Russian ICBMs, which was the initial idea behind SpaceX. He wasn't going to develop his own rockets. He was going to use Russian ICBMs. They went to Russia on a trip together to try to source these. That didn't pan out. But the InQtel investment manager who had accompanied him went on to become a NASA administrator, and in 2008 awarded SpaceX this beautiful contract for billions of dollars that Elon Musk says saved the company. So people who think Elon Musk is going to be their savior, I think, are sadly deluded.
He must have been a young, ambitious entrepreneur going to buy ICBMs in Russia, as you do. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stories on the Elon Musk front. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Florida, Cape Canaveral, as a young kid, and NASA was like, you know, we're kids in the 70s,
sure.
Star Wars launches, and the space shuttle was the piggybacking on the back of a Boeing, and you could kind of see it some days. We had this idea that we were going to space, and I noticed there's a lot more interest now because of SpaceX in the idea of space, but it's and then trading and moon industrial usages of the moon and so forth. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of investment in this right now. What do you think about this trend?
Well, you talked about Starlink earlier, and of course we know that SpaceX has billions of dollars worth of DoD contracts. Of course, we don't know everything it is doing for the DoD because, of course, it's classified and whatever they're sending up there, but that's definitely a part of this. It's also to do with NATO's declaration of the weaponization of space. Space is the new war fighting grounds. And even in the time that I've been here in the UK, I understand there's been some developments with North Korea threatening to launch something, a satellite of some sort, and Japan responding, if you launch anything over the Sea of Japan, we're going to respond, we're going to shoot it down, whatever. Which apparently prompted an American response, seemingly out of the blue, just, hey guys, just letting you know that we are capable of fighting a war in space today if need be. So that, at any rate, you want to talk about military boondoggles. I think this is the ultimate military boondoggle, because who even knows what is going on up there? What's happening? It can ultimately, not to beat a dead horse, but it could be that 1984 situation of, well, those bombs are raining down on us and they say it's East Asia this week. Okay, I guess it's them, or it could be our own government. Who knows? In this case, well, something's happening in space and, well, they say it's the Chinese, but whatever. Anyway, we're at war now.
I see a trend. We got a couple minutes left. I see a trend of the open internet becoming a managed, balkanized set of walled gardens. And this is like totally antithetical to the spirit of the original internet when we were starting to use it. And I'm getting that vibe that I'm seeing a lot of. In the UK, they banned a lot of URLs like RT.com. There's no Russian media here. So they said, no good Russian propaganda, so can't watch that. And they're starting to go after URLs, I noticed, for different reasons. So that's one thing I think to be worried about going forward.
Absolutely it is. And I think, again, it points to the fundamental problem that we are facing, which is centralization and the logic of centralization. Just the domain name system, the DNS registry itself, the fact that it is a centralized thing, which... in a sense, it would be, I understand why it exists and how it developed, but the idea that some sort of central organization is going to control essentially the phone book for the internet is obviously going to be weaponized. If it can be weaponized, it will. Just in the exact same way that for years they claimed SWIFT is a completely non-governmental organization, there's no way it can be weaponized. And, oh yeah, in 2012, yeah, we did delist Iran and all of that. But don't worry, it's not, this isn't a political weapon. And of course, what do they do as soon as the Ukraine war kicked off? Of course, they delist Russia and a number of banks. Anything that can be weaponized will be weaponized. And domain name system, anything else is fair game for it, according to them, anyway.
It's amazing that the internet, the global internet, so much of it, the architecture of it is... has kind of got U.S. Fingerprints on it.
Exactly. Again, not a coincidence. If you trace the historical continuity back to its roots, the internet was a network that was meant for military warfighting purposes. It was developed, obviously, by ARPA, became DARPA, and it was developed for military purposes, as even Vint Cerf has talked about. Of course, this was an idea for a network. Of course, they put out the idea. It's for, in case of nuclear holocaust, it would be a network that would be able to survive. You know, no one node would be central to it. But oh, by the way, it's also perfect for if you happen to go into a country and start invading that country, and you don't want to drag along all your network infrastructure with you. You need it deployed in the country already. This is the way to do it. And so that was the initial impetus. And of course, there were the idealistic Silicon Valley nerds who were recruited by DARPA, but they were all working for military intelligence at the time. And interestingly, if you read the work of, the name is going to escape me, but he wrote about Surveillance Valley, and he traced the history of Silicon Valley back to the 1950s, 60s, when it was developing. And he talked about, at that time, you were having protests on American campuses against the idea of the internet, early iteration of that, because it was understood that this was being developed essentially being developed as part of the Vietnam War effort at that time as a way of cataloging and databasing and tracking counterinsurgency. And there was a lot of protest about the octopus, as it was being called and referred to as the digital octopus is going to, you know, control, track everyone. Weirdly, that whole side part of history kind of got lost somewhere, and we got this information superhighway idea that it's, oh, don't worry, it's just coming from the clouds to save us.
Octopus, that's the Spectre, the Spectre logo.
Yeah, it's also Danny Castellero in all of that.
James Corbett, amazing. Really appreciate you joining us here at our pop-up studio at TNT Radio at the Better Way Conference. And just before we go, give a shout-out for your panel discussions this week. When are they and what are they titled?
So tomorrow I am hosting a conversation on AI and transhumanism, and I will be speaking at a conversation on electro-smog and electro-frequencies and how they can be weaponized. And then on Sunday, I am going to be speaking at a panel on From Thought Control to Free Thought. And I will be hosting a panel on One Health, the concept of One Health that's being propounded by the World Health Organization right now.
Yeah, that's the zoonosis is the sort of component in there. That's I'm glad you guys are covering that because that's a big one.
Sure.
But James Corbett, amazing. Good luck with the rest of your presentations this week and also with your work going forward. And hopefully we'll be able to catch up again soon.
Awesome. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, James Corbett. Amazing. And we got a couple minutes left. We're going to slide, if we possible, Clive DeCarl. I don't know if Clive is still available. He's been busy today. I heard, Clive, you were showing off your Tesla advanced technology, and a lot of people were very impressed with what they saw. How's the reaction been to this?
Well, I've treated, after my talk, I had a whole queue of people, probably about 30 people, and I'm pretty sure I got them all out of pain. All of them. With a machine that was invented in 1891.
So good results so far.
Good results so far.
Yeah, yes. No, I people are very impressed. I mean, the thing they're impressed with is the visual aspect of it as well. It's kind of like a it looks like throwback technology.
Yeah, so yeah, no, it's good Frankenstein-type machinery. Yeah. Lights up and makes buzzing noises.
Victorian era device. So, Clive, on the panel side, just give us a shout. We got a couple of minutes left. Which panels are you going to be presenting or participating in?
I was on the first panel today, but I didn't get actually a chance to speak. Everybody else did a lot of speaking. I was just about to speak, and it was over. Oh, what I would have said, because everybody was going on about viruses, and they've never isolated a virus. So how can they have all these variants, or even COVID itself, if it's never been isolated? You know, freedom of request information has been put in all over the world, and they can't produce the virus. So how can they test for it? How do they know it exists? You see, I consider that 5G, chemtrails, poisoning in the water, wherever, might be what's been making people ill. I'm not convinced there is actually a virus that's doing it. People are ill, obviously. Lots of people get ill. But I'm not sure it's what they're saying.
Other environmental factors could make people ill, not necessarily a sub-microscopic particle, is what you're saying. It could be something else, many things.
Well, it could be. And, you know, because they've never proved that a virus exists, I find the theory of viruses hard to completely believe. I mean, it does seem pretty obvious that people appear to be catching something from somebody else, but they've actually tried infecting people deliberately, shoving snot up other people's noses and stuff, and they haven't proved infection. You'd think they would, that
contagion.
Contagion.
Well, look, that's this is a conversation I wish there was more of here, honestly. And hopefully I will put a few signals out to the committee that next year, if they're going to have a panel discussion, definitely that includes that. The germ theory, terrain theory debate needs to happen. And I'd like to see you on that panel yourself, Clive, as one of the speakers for that. But we're going to wrap up this hour here. Clive DeCarl, James Corbett, Derek Rose, Dr. Simon Godak, Robin Minotti, and Basil Valentine. This has been a great all-around discussion. It's been a great weekend. There's still two more days left. We'll be here to do more reporting, but we're going to move on to Twitter to do that. So from Patrick Henningsen here at the Federal Way Conference in Bath, England, we are signing out. So stick around, though. Stay on the network. There's more coming up after the top of the hour news headlines. I will see you guys next week. Take care.